we're doing this for our people to best give good quality patient care.
Norton Sound Health Aides prepare to go on strike. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Department of Health is moving some jobs related to an in-state health survey out of state.
Our average employee only lasted about 6 months. So as much as we wanted to keep it open here, it just wasn't doing the job.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Health aides in 15 communities across the Norton Sound area are set to go on strike Monday if a dispute with hospital administration is not resolved. They say administrators are instituting unfair labor practices and ultimately causing harm to their health and their ability to care for patients. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
The dispute centers on Barbara Collins, the director of Village Health Services for Norton Sound Health Corporation. The Community Health Aid Association says that Collins has made employment conditions, quote, intolerable for aides. They say 48 aides, or nearly 70% of the workforce, have resigned or been fired since Collins took the position 18 months ago. Sharon Johnson is a community health aide in Unalakleet and the president of the Community Health Aid Association. Johnson says they've given hospital leadership numerous complaints about Ms. Collins. They are now calling for her to be fired for the strike to be averted. Johnson says, to begin with, Collins is not qualified for the job.
She doesn't understand how VHS operates, or she doesn't know how it is to work in a village as a health aide. She had no concept of that.
Aides are also asking that the person who hired her, Mary David, the assistant vice president for hospital services, be terminated as well. Johnson says that aides have brought their issues regarding Ms. Collins to hospital administration in the past.
We have voiced our concern about her, and we were only shot down.
The health aides say that Collins and Norton Sound Health Corporation leadership have failed to provide for employees following critical incident care, leading to post-traumatic stress syndrome among aides, and eventually resignations, self-medication, and even suicide. Johnson says it's become a matter of health for patients and employees.
We're doing this for our people, to best give good quality patient care. We need to take care of our workplace also, be able to come to work without feeling harassed and belittled. We all enjoy our job. We want somebody that supports us in that.
The Health Aides Proclamation also cites labor practices like requiring aides to take vacation time after working nights and weekends and being called into work during their vacations. And given the high turnover in the past year and a half, aides want staff who have been pushed out or resigned to have an opportunity to be rehired. Hospital administration and the board met this afternoon to discuss the situation. CEO Devin Parlicker says because it is an internal personnel issue, he is not able to comment. 5 days before the possible strike begins, Johnson says she's gotten the signatures of 43 of 51 health aides from 15 clinics. Health aides are the only provider in many communities. Johnson says that if the strike goes through, aides will respond to emergencies, but will not see regularly scheduled patients.
Other than, you know, having emergencies, of course, we will take care of them. But I'm hoping that it won't go this far.
The aides say they are prepared to strike beginning on Monday. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Department of Health and Social Services is carrying through with plans to close the office that gathers raw data for its annual behavior risk survey. The survey, which began in 1991, is an analysis of health-related activities of the adults in the state, pointing out lifestyle choices and activities that would impact health. The anonymous survey asks telephone respondents about such things as smoking, alcohol use, dietary habits, and exercise. Working with the Federal Centers for Disease Control and all 50 states, the department spokesman Greg Wilkinson says the information is used to determine what needs to be done to improve public health.
basically, it helps us know, as a public health agency, what lifestyle choices people are making that we could help them make better choices.
A similar annual survey is done in some of the state's schools to determine possible health risks taken by the state's young people. Wilkinson says the survey will continue, but will not be done in Alaska. Phone calls to Alaskans will come from the University of Missouri. Wilkinson says the cost savings will provide money for an additional 5,000 attempts per year on landlines and cell phones. And he says that will provide more data that will give a better picture of Alaskans' health issues. The survey employed 7 people full-time and 4 part-time in the state. Sending those jobs outside is drawing fire from legislators. Juneau Democratic Senator Dennis Egan says there are Alaskans ready to take the jobs.
Ann Goon could do these surveys. I mean, Ann Goon has enough bandwidth and enough people that want employment in a community the size of Ann Goon. And you know, it doesn't have to be, with these jobs, but I think it has to be Alaska.
Wilkinson says the department would prefer to have jobs in Alaska, but the final decision was based on troubles that management had in finding people to do the work.
Our average employee only lasted about 6 months, and then it would take us 6 to 8 weeks to train a new one. Our average position sat vacant for 122 days. We had over 5,000 missed days since 2005. So as much as we wanted to keep it open here, it just wasn't doing the job.
Egan says the department gave no consideration of discussing in-state options with any of the tribal or corporate Native organizations that could help relocate the office to rural Alaska, where there are people to work for the $367,000 annual payroll. The union representing the office's current employees last month offered several options to avoid moving the service out of state. Among them was to expand its workload to include surveys done by other executive branch departments, such as the Departments of Fish and Game, Transportation, and Labor. In his most recent decision on the subject, Health and Social Services Commissioner William Struer rejected the alternatives, saying they showed neither a financial savings nor a way to address the problem of keeping workers on the job. Governor Parnell has made jobs for Alaskans a campaign issue, but Egan says the governor did not reply to written concerns sent by legislators last spring. The issue will arise during the legislative session that begins in January. An Alaska man is one of the fatalities in a helicopter accident yesterday at Joint Base Lewis McChord in Washington. Chief Warrant Officer Joseph S. Satterfield was a native of Alaska. He and 3 others died when 2 helicopters crashed during training at the Washington Army base. An investigation into the cause of the accident by a team from Fort Rucker, Alabama, began today. Lieutenant Colonel Gary Dangerfield says the investigation could take as long as a year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, evaluating the mercury level on a popular Juneau beach.
Anyone from Juneau or Douglas knows that there's a lot of crab pots in that area.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Democrats and Republicans are wrestling over how to pay for continuing the payroll tax holiday that's been in effect this year. Last night, the Republican-led U.S. House passed their version of a bill that carries the tax cut into next year, indicating that both sides of the aisle want to keep it on the books. Democrats have been pushing to extend the tax break, saying it helps middle-class Americans, but there's no agreement on the way to do it. Republicans loaded their bill with add-ons that some Democrats oppose, and Democrats are balking at the way Republicans would pay for the tax cut. Alaska Congressman Don Young joined most of his Republican colleagues in voting for the bill, which passed 234 to 193. All but 10 Democrats voted against it. They don't like that it would be paid for by increasing Medicare premiums, shortening the amount of time America's jobless could claim unemployment insurance, and continuing a freeze on federal workers' pay. Those are deal breakers for Democratic Senator Mark Begich. He's long been a supporter of continuing the payroll tax cut, which affects 400,000 Alaskans.
On an average, when you look at it, you know, family under $50,000 in income receiving about $1,000 additional relief, tax relief, I think is good. And not putting that money in the black hole of the federal government, I think is a good thing. So I think there's a lot of opportunity on this one. It's just tweaking through the pay force.
Democrats have proposed paying for the payroll tax break by raising taxes on millionaires, but today leadership admitted they might have to drop that plan. Another sticking point is that Republicans inserted in their bill language that would fast-track the proposed Keystone XL oil pipeline extension from Canada down to the lower 48. Many Democrats don't like that, but Senator Begich is supportive of moving the project forward, and his office says that's not a problem. The hang-up over how to pay for the payroll tax cut is clogging up the rest of what Congress has to accomplish before it leaves for the winter holiday. They have to pass a massive spending bill, or the government will shut down this weekend. Leaders of both parties say they're close to agreement on the $1 trillion spending bill, but they're waiting to get the payroll tax cut plan hammered out first. A popular Juneau recreation area is being checked for mercury contamination. Preliminary tests of Sandy Beach on Douglas Island show high levels, most likely from a long-closed mine nearby. But officials say there's no need to stay away. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
This time of year, the tidal flats of Sandy Beach are mostly used by dog owners trying to wear out their pooches. In warmer seasons, it's a favorite place for castle-building kids, picnicking parents, and the occasional pallet-powered bonfire. But for decades, it was a Tlingit village, at times reaching a population of 600. The Douglas Indian Association, the area's tribal government, has been concerned about hazardous substances in the sand. So last summer, high schoolers in a tribal environmental program took samples and sent them off for analysis.
Well, they called us right away, and they wanted to make sure we disposed of our collection pails and our gloves because they knew that there was some elevated mercury there.
That's Eric Morrison, environmental planner at the Douglas Indian Association. Along with mercury, there's arsenic and cyanide, once used in the nearby Treadwell mine. Similar issues have been raised over plans to dredge a nearby harbor. The sand and mud removed was to be placed on the ocean floor. The beach and low tide zones are largely ground-up waste rock from the mine. Whatever hazardous substances it holds could be getting into seafood collected for subsistence and personal use.
Anyone from Juneau and Douglas knows that there's a lot of crab pots in that area, so that's one of the things we're hoping to do is to test some of the crab and clams for methylmercury content.
Well, the indications are that we need more information.
Bruce Wanstall is with the State Department of Environmental Conservation's Contaminated Sites Program. He's met with the tribal government and the city of Juneau, which owns and manages the beach. He understands some people might worry about what's been found, but they really shouldn't.
They don't suggest that there's an immediate risk to human health or the environment at this time, but it does indicate that we should conduct a more in-depth and wider set of sampling.
Before officials do more work, they have to find funding, and they'll seek grants. No one's given the city a deadline, but Juneau Parks and Recreation Director Brent Fisher says it will get done.
I want to do it. It's timely. It's our responsibility to make sure that there isn't a risk. And so I look at it as it is a priority on my table.
He says areas that are most suspected are actually below the sandiest part of the beach. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Fort Wainwright will lose up to 62 civilian jobs in the coming year as part of the Army's share of cutbacks intended to reduce federal spending and the nation's budget deficit. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Most of the 78 civilian positions statewide that the Army says it may eliminate in the coming year will come from Fort Wainwright. Fort Greely, near Delta Junction, may lose 6 positions, and up to 10 may be lost on the Army side of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Lieutenant Colonel Rodney Crum, a U.S. Army Alaska spokesman at Elmendorf-Richardson, says those are all preliminary numbers that are still being sorted out.
Nobody's for sure how many. These are just possible reductions.
Crum says the Army is trying to keep that number down to minimize the impact on its civil service workers in Alaska.
We're kind of in the process of executing every option we have in order to get that number down to the fewest possible.
Crum couldn't say how many of those positions are presently filled, nor the kinds of jobs that would be eliminated under the reductions. The cutbacks announced Friday would affect at most a little more than 3% of the 2,200 civilians who work for the Army in Alaska. Nationwide, some 330,000 civilians work for the Army. The service plans to trim that workforce by some 8,700 positions by September 30th. That would meet the Army's goal of reducing its workforce to fiscal year 2010 levels. The Air Force is also cutting back. The service announced last month that it will eliminate more than 250 civil service positions in Alaska by April 1st, most of which will be cut at Elmendorf-Richardson. Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks would lose 45 positions. The cutbacks are all part of the federal government's efforts to trim some $350 billion from the Defense Department's budget over the next 10 years. The federal government is the third largest employer in Alaska. Most of the 16,000 federal employees statewide work for Defense Department agencies. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
One of the largest bipartisan groups of state elected officials will campaign in favor of petroleum development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The National Conference of State Legislatures this month approved a resolution supporting the opening of ANWR, making it part of the group's national policy and adding its input to the issue if it comes before the federal government. The resolution was sponsored by Eagle River Republican Dan Sadler.
It's a long-running organization, and it does speak very clearly and on an informed basis on the state's agenda to Washington. So when the state, in the form of NCSO, when the states go to D.C. to lobby for more money, for jobs, for whatever issues, they have this policy directive behind them saying that, yes, NCSO supports considering and opening up ANWR to responsible development. That packs a punch, and then Congress will have to listen.
Sadler says the resolution will be voted on again at another NCSL meeting next summer. The Speaker of the State House does not have encouraging news on prospects for an Alaska gas pipeline. In an address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday, Speaker Mike Chenault of Kenai said the state is bound by the AGIA contract with TransCanada and ExxonMobil and cannot pursue another large-diameter gas line without facing triple damages. Chenault sponsored a bill that funded state investigation of a small-diameter in-state line that fits under a volume cap in AGIA, but told chamber members there are other obstacles to any pipeline project.
At the end of the day, I really don't care if a line goes from Prudhoe Bay to the Cook Inlet or that it goes from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez. But it's going to have to be economical. You have to have customers. And you got to have people willing to sell you the gas to ship. And those are the things that you've got to have. Without those, you don't get the investment dollars to build it.
Chenault said the state should not invest billions in an Alaska gas line without confirmed gas sellers and buyers. Chenault said a North Slope gas supply is a problem, and the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission would not approve gas export if the state had a pipeline ready right now.
AOGCC, if we could take 4.5 Bcf of gas, or even 2.7 Bcf of gas a day, off the Prudhoe Bay cap today, if we had a pipeline, they would say no. They would not allow that gas to be taken off the cap because it would lower the amount of oil that could be produced in that oil field over its lifetime. So there's always an issue of when can you get to that gas.
Gas is currently re-injected to increase pressure and oil output from the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir. Chenault said nearby Point Thompson holds great prospect for gas, but it's unclear until further exploration takes place how much oil or high-value gas condensate would have to be developed there before gas could be pumped out. Chenault says he will continue to push for the in-state North Slope to South Central line being pursued by the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, but is not turning his back on the AGIA export line to Canada. The Pebble Mine is the most talked about and controversial proposed mining project in southwest Alaska, but it's not the only project being looked at. For several years, a handful of companies have also been exploring for a mineral resource in the areas around and near the Pebble deposit. One of those companies is Liberty Star Uranium and Metals Corporation, which has the rights to develop what it is calling the Big Chunk Super Project. The company is reviewing a new technical report on the resource. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The report finds that the drill holes in the Big Chunk area that were drilled back in 2004 and 2005 found copper zones very much like those found in the Pebble deposit. In a prepared statement, Liberty Star's CEO and chief geologist noted that the technical report substantiates what the company has surmised about the areas. James Briscoe is quoted as saying that there are multiple targets that, according to the latest imaging techniques, mirror what the company knows exists at the nearby Pebble project. He went on to note that with the prices of copper, gold, and moly at such high levels, the time has arrived to pick the best targets on the Big Chunk claims and move to the next phase of exploration. The next phase is apparently more drilling, and Briscoe confirmed that he's working on a detailed drilling plan and has tasked the company's president with finding funding for the drilling project. Briscoe asserted that the company is discussing funding with multiple potential partners, both domestic and foreign. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Two proposals to establish subsistence-only zones for herring in Sitka Sound failed to win recommendation from the Sitka Fish and Game Advisory Committee in a contentious meeting last week. Subsistence harvesters say the commercial seine fishery is having a negative effect on their ability to gather herring eggs on hemlock branches, which is a traditional food for Southeast natives. Every 3 years, the State Board of Fish reviews how herring are managed. When the board meets in February, it will consider some proposals designed to address the conflict between subsistence users and seiners and find some compromise. But if testimony at last week's meeting of the Sitka Fish and Game Advisory Committee is any indication, compromise will not be easy. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The two proposals before the Board of Fish seek to establish subsistence-only zones for herring in Sitka Sound. The zones encompass an area along Sitka's road system from just south of O'Connell Bridge all the way up to the Gavansky Islands. The Sitka Sound sacro herring fishery is one of the most competitive and expensive commercial fisheries in the state. About 50 seine boats fish it, and the average permit is worth more than $500,000. Openings are fast and furious, with boats scrambling to seine as many herring as possible in a short amount of time and over a relatively small area. Steve Reifenstuhl represents the Southeast Herring Conservation Alliance, which is made up mostly of commercial fishermen. He says the proposals to develop subsistence-only zones are not based on good science or math.
So what this is really about is chipping away at the edges, and it's not necessary to do. I think that, again, the department has demonstrated a good faith effort in prosecuting this fishery, and I think that subsistence needs have been met and will be met.
Subsistence harvesters like Tom Gamble disagree.
You get your quota. But we've shown again on record that there were at least three times in our books within the last 5 to 6 years where we did not meet our needs.
Subsistence harvesters fell short of a yearly number called the amount necessary for subsistence in 2005, 2007, and 2008. The area that would be subsistence only under the proposals includes waters that have provided herring openings for the commercial fleet. Fish and Game commercial fisheries biologist Dave Gordon says if the zones were in place, there could be some years where meeting the GHL, or guideline harvest level, of herring would be a challenge. But Gamble, the subsistence harvester, says the zone is a small area compared to where the commercial fleet can find herring.
And we're not asking for you guys to close down your entire fishery forever and ever. We're not saying that the GHL has to be amended or the process that you use in determining your GHL needs to be amended. We're asking for a very small portion.
Those weren't the only issues during Tuesday night's discussion. There were also disagreements over broader issues, like the intersection of traditional knowledge and government science. And there were calls for compromise. One of those calls came from George Bennett. He stood up at the back of the room and said a lot of subsistence harvesters, like him, also have been commercial fishermen and are not unsympathetic to the needs of the industry.
We know when it was good, and it's not that good now. And these guys have to fight for every place they need to make money and live. And we know that. But somewhere along the line, there has to be a compromise.
To do otherwise, Bennett said, will just mean angrier discussions in the future and more disagreement. At one point, advisory committee member Jack Lorigan asked point blank if there was room to budge.
If I was to ask the industry right now, without the benefit of talking to all 52 seniors, is there an area in there that you'd be willing to talk about?
People in the audience looked at one another, not saying anything, until Saner Mitch Idy broke the silence.
On my part, I'd have to say no, because I'm not convinced there's any correlation between us being there and not being there. There's the numbers, I'm not going to call it data, that they put up there. It looked to me like there was one year where it could have been an effect, one year where it definitely wasn't, and then another year where it was kind of questionable. We didn't catch a lot of fish there. Wasn't a big subsistence year. I don't see the evidence to justify closing that area to commercial fishing.
The same question later was put to Harvey Kitka, chairman of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Herring Committee. Is there room for compromise?
Not a whole lot. I think there might be, but I really think we've compromised far beyond what we could have already.
After the subsistence-only zones failed to win recommendation from the advisory committee, a motion was made to encourage both sides to continue working toward consensus. The advisory committee's recommendations are just that. The Board of Fish will consider them, but ultimately is free to do whatever it wants when it meets in February. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.